I've called today's sermon, Our Common Fight, Basic Survival Rules. Don't know if you have those, but I remember in 1982, so I was 20, and at that age I was invincible, of course. I was super fit, and I wanted to prove it. So I heard about this course. I lived in London at the time, and I heard about this course where you could apply to join the Territorial Army, SAS. Stop laughing, Paul. So, and it was the most, I think it still is, but it definitely was at that time, the most demanding, challenging civilian course in the world. I was invincible and fit. That was for me. So me and my friend, we did months and months of personal training, running around Hyde Park with a backpack on our backs, filled with bricks and all kinds of things like that. And then we turned up at the Duke of York's barracks in Sloane Square, which is where then the London headquarters was. And we passed the basic fitness test, which was good, which allowed us to go onto the selection course. Well, if you pass that selection course, a civilian can go directly into the full-time SAS. This tells you how tough that course is, that you're respected sufficiently well to apply immediately into the full-time regular SAS squadron. Well, do you remember earlier this month, I was reminded of those days because we heard about two young men who died, didn't they, on that course. On the Brecon Beacons, whilst taking part in that selection process. And I was looking at some of the pictures, and I remember that I marched some of those marches, and in both day and by night, and in extreme weather, but not the extreme weather that they had. They had extreme heat. We were doing ours in quite a lot of cold, in winter time. But it's meant to be a testing course. And I was reminded, thinking about that, that we were given, before we went out on the mountains of South Wales, we were given basic rules of survival. This is what you must do when you're struggling. It was so well drilled into us, I could still remember them vividly. So they wouldn't let us loose on these Welsh mountains until we had this instruction given to us. The great danger, of course, on a winter selection course is going to be hypothermia, which is where your body just gets too cold. And they taught us how to recognize the symptoms of hypothermia. And they said, if someone in your group shows signs of hypothermia, and basically they begin to look like they're drunk, they act like they're tipsy, they start slurring their words, they get a little bit out of focus and disoriented, early signs of hypothermia. If someone starts acting like that in your group, you go out in fours. So a group of four, you look after each other on the mountains. Then his life is in danger. At that stage, he is in danger. His life is in danger. You must get him off the mountain. Forget the task. Get him off the mountain. So how do you get off a featureless Welsh mountain at night in winter safely? Good question, isn't it? You can't read a map. Well, they drop you on the mountain. You've got no idea where you are anyhow, so you wouldn't even be able to find yourself on the map if you had a map. You can't make out any contours because those mountains are all kind of quite samey. There are one or two that stand out, but most of them are just featureless. Snow, yeah, yeah. Two men on our course, or two men on the course before us died of hypothermia. And nothing's familiar to you. Well, these were the basic rules they gave us and that we were issued with in 1982. I don't know whether it's the same now. How do you get off the mountain safely and quickly? One, keep walking until you come to flowing or running water. You're going to find that in Wales, aren't you? Then follow the water downhill until you come to a bridge. And then follow the road that's on that bridge until you come, follow that road downhill until you come to a house or a phone box. Okay, that tells you how long ago that was, doesn't it? Okay, no mobile phones in 1982. And then, whether it's a phone box or a house, you ring the emergency number in Hereford, and they will come and rescue you. If necessary, sending out a helicopter. Now, I found those basic rules of survival very reassuring when the four of us, on one nasty winter's night, were out on top of one of these featureless hills. Clearly, these military boys had been there. Some of these guys training us were full-time SAS boys. They knew what they were talking about. And so you took this information to heart. And also, I found them very easy to remember. I still can remember them. And that's what you need, isn't it? When your energy levels are low and your resources are running out, you don't need to have to work too hard to remember the basics. Well, a few weeks on from that basic training, we were out on night exercise. And our group of four, and we had to put those rules into practice. Because one of our group was getting hypothermia. Took us a little time to work it out, but eventually we realized, yeah, he's acting as if he's had 3 pints too many. And so we did exactly as the basic rules of survival said. We found a stream, we followed it downhill, we found a bridge, we followed the road, and the first thing we came to was a house at 3 o'clock in the morning. But this is basic survival. You're not too worried about getting somebody up at that time in the morning if you've got a man down and he needs help. So we banged on the door quite hard. It's amazing. It was a farmer, so I think farmers never really go to sleep, do they? I think sometimes. So he was very quickly at the door, and he recognized who we were immediately, and he just said, I can't do the Welsh accent. Maybe Esther could or someone. But he said, I wouldn't even put my sheep out on the mountain in this weather. It was a foul night. And he knew exactly what we'd been doing. And he pulled us in and gave us tea and put the poor guy by the fire. Basic rules of survival. They're really important. And they work. There are times in our common fight against sin, that ongoing presence of sin in our lives, when we, or maybe one of our members, somebody we're walking the Christian life with in this church, becomes confused, disoriented, vulnerable, weak, and easy prey, perhaps, for the evil one. And I want just to give us this morning two basic rules of survival. Not four. There are four, but I haven't got time to do four. I want to do two basic rules of survival. And it's a very simple message. Just like the basic training was very simple, but it was a lifesaver in our case. And I think if you remember these two things, they will be of great value to you in this our common fight against sin. The two things are very simple. Remember, God is always in control. And remember, God is always good. Those two rules I've taken from basic rules of survival, I've taken from Psalm 62. So let's turn to Psalm 62 together. That's on page 574 in the Church Bibles. And I'm going to read the whole psalm to us. If we take these basic rules into the heat of the battle with us, they will always lead us to safety. So this Psalm 62 is a psalm of David. It's focusing on a time of trouble that he was experiencing, in particular wicked people coming against him. But we can apply it equally well as the time of trouble that we experience in our fight against sin when the devil is trying to pull us down. It emphasizes that safety is found in God alone. He is our rock and our fortress. And it encourages us, the reader, to stay faithful by holding on to the knowledge of God, which we know certainly to be true. A bit like John Newton's hymn, "The Lord Will Provide." Hold on to basics of real value. They will keep you steady. And there's two there that we're going to look at in a minute. So let's read this psalm. To the choir master, according to Jeduthun, a psalm of David. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. And it does feel, doesn't it, sometimes in this common fight against sin, that we're just a tottering wall. We're just waiting to be pushed over. One last bit of pressure and over we go. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is in him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge, is God. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Those of low estate are but a breath. And those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances, they go up. They are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this. So these are the two basic rules of survival. That power belongs to God. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. For you will render to a man according to his work. So verses 11 to 12, did you hear it as I picked it out for you? Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this. That power belongs to God. And the heading I'm giving for this is that remember that God is always in control. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. God is always good. That's what those two things mean and boil down to for us. So remember, God is always in control, that power belongs to God. So this is the consistent message of the Bible. Power belongs to God. That makes him all-powerful. If it belongs to him, it makes him all-powerful, doesn't it? It's not something that God has alongside others. It's his basic attribute. God is power. It belongs to him. He's all-powerful. And being all-powerful, he is able to accomplish all that he plans and purposes. There's no weakness or inability in God. Our own article of faith that we confirmed and affirmed when we renewed our covenant earlier this year states this: God controls how many things? All things, according to his wisdom and power. It's not according to random chance. God controls all things according to his wisdom and his power. Power belongs to God. God is in control. Now, many people outside of the church perhaps look at the world and they observe what to them looks like chaos, confusion. They see the calamities that take place and the conflicts. And they come, perhaps understandably, to the conclusion that if God created the world and it was all good, then somehow God seems to have lost control. That God's wisdom, his plan, and his purposes are now mocked in some way, and that therefore his power has left him. You may have encountered that argument from people you work with when they say, "So why doesn't God do something? Well, that's being driven by a thought that God's lost control. Isn't it? The presupposition is that God can't be in control if someone's turning around to you and saying, why doesn't God do something about this? Others think that God must have abandoned his creation. So they don't necessarily say that God is out of control. They just think, well, he's kind of got bored with it and perhaps gone off to some other distant galaxy where he's amusing himself and leaving us to chance. The Bible affirms that despite appearances to the contrary, God is always and still always in control. That his wisdom, his plan, and his purposes, his power are still doing exactly as he decided in the very beginning. That his power is constantly at work, putting his perfect will into practice. Nothing lies outside of his sovereign or kingly control. Now, I know that's, if we're believers here and members here especially, that's what we believe. I haven't said to you anything new or shocking. But for a believer, the devil is constantly wanting us to swallow a lie. He wants us to believe that somehow, in our particular circumstances that we face, maybe the circumstances you faced last week, or the ones that you're facing next week, that somehow God in those circumstances wasn't quite in control. Now, he doesn't feed that lie to us in that way. But the upshot is this: when life does not go according to our plan, and we've talked about this, haven't we? Very often we have an unwritten plan as to how our life needs to pan out. And when life doesn't go according to that plan, or our expectations for what our life will become or be, or even our preferences for what might happen in that day. At that point, when life doesn't play ball with us, at that point we become one of those vulnerable ones on the mountains, as it were. We are vulnerable to temptation. And we need to remember that God is always in control. It's his plan that matters, not ours. So, our computer crashes. Ours did this morning, actually. Our laptop crashed just as we were setting it up. In God's providence, David had brought his spare laptop, so we were able to carry on with the technology. But our laptop crashes, and we can't get the thing done that we needed to do with the laptop, as we planned to do. And what's our immediate response? Frustration, possibly. We've been learning about that in our common fight, haven't we? We're delayed in traffic, and we're going to miss our appointment. What's your response? Is it that God is in control? Always. That's the basic rule of survival, isn't it? If you drop that rule, you're going to get down the road of getting very frustrated. We receive an unexpected bill, and we have no idea how we're going to pay it. A car breaks down. Somebody this week told me their turbo went. And I thought, oh, no. That can be very expensive. Big challenge, isn't it? Is God in control? Basic rule. Remember it. We have a health problem. Or we fear we have a health problem. Is God in control? Basic rule of survival. Forget it, and you go down the wrong road. Our child has learning difficulties, and we fear, we even lie awake at night wondering about their future. How on earth are they going to cope? What's the basic rule? God is always in control. He hasn't forgotten. Simple, isn't it? But so easy to forget that basic rule. I remember Sophie wanting to, doing A-levels, I think, was keen to get a certain grade in an exam because that would open the door to a future that she had planned. Well, she didn't get the grade in the exam. What's the basic rule? God is always in control. And we can look back now and see something of that providence, that failure, that people would call that a failure, was part of God's way of opening a door for Sophie to study languages rather than medicine. God is always in control. We can't always see things looking back that quickly, can we? But the basic rule, first basic rule of survival, is to get this truth that we all up here, I think, would say yes to, get it into here. So it becomes instinctive. When we recognize that we're vulnerable, that kind of drowsy state where something's hit us by surprise, that rule comes to our mind. God is always in control. It's his plan that matters, not ours. It's interesting that I think most believers believe this up to the point where life in their understanding seems to suddenly go wrong. Okay? It's very easy to believe that God is in control for as long as life is doing the things we expect life to do for us. But this is where this is a survival rule. It's when life takes a turn for what we regard as the worse, that this rule has to come into play. Otherwise, your common fight's going to be a bit of a disaster on a daily basis. So the great thing is to carry this truth from the training ground. Where's the training ground? That's here. This is the training ground, isn't it? You're learning here how to live. You're being taught God's word, being told how to survive out there in the week. And so here you can nod your head and say yes, but on Monday morning, when you get the bill, or whatever it is, will you nod your head and go, God is always in control? C.S. Lewis was a great author and philosopher, and you may know him because he wrote the Narnia stories, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and so on. But he wrote helpful books, one called Mere Christianity. He was a Christian, and he said something very helpful. He said, the moment you wake up each morning, all your wishes and hopes, we could add expectations, plans for the day, they come rushing at you like wild animals. Do you see what the picture he's giving? And the first job of the day consists in shoving them all back. Isn't that interesting? The moment you wake each morning, all your wishes and hopes for the day rush at you like wild animals. And the first job of the day consists in shoving them all back, in listening to that other voice, that other point of view, letting that other, stronger, quieter life come flowing in. Remembering then that God is always in control. It's interesting, isn't it? Very helpful. Is that in the sheet? Did I put that in the sheet? I think you might find that helpful to have that with you during the course of the week. And just picture, so when you wake up, those wild beasts flying at you, your expectations, your plans, your hopes, they're not your friends really, in many ways. Your friend is when you wake up and say, God is in control. Help me get through this day in his way. So one thing God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God. So God is always in control. Take that truth into the battlefield that you wake up on each morning, and it will serve you well as you learn to trust him in the practical and daily trials that we all face. Encourage one another with it as well when somebody's struggling. Secondly, second basic rule of survival, remember that God is always good. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God. He's always in control. And that to you, O Lord, again belongs steadfast love. Goodness. God is always good. Once again, it's the consistent message of the Bible. You may recall the rich young man who ran up to Jesus and said, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Do you remember that? And Jesus said to him, good teacher. No one is good but God alone. Mark 10:18, that is. However, the devil has filled the world with another lie, and this is the lie that God somehow wants to rob us of our joy. That somehow we can't be happy at the same time as really being with God. That's what people in the world believe, isn't it? They think that if you go to joy, you just can't possibly be happy. You can't possibly be enjoying, truly enjoying life, because they've got all this list of things in their head that they wouldn't be able to do if they go to church, as far as they're concerned. You know, that mental list that they would have. So God's a kind of cosmic killjoy, a party pooper. And that's what the devil says to the world, and that's what the devil will keep saying to us when we come into Christ's kingdom. He's not really out for your joy. He's hoodwinking you. So let's read the parable of the prodigal son. Mike, did you preach on this the other week? Should get Mike up here now, shouldn't I? So this is Luke 15, I think, verses 11 to 32, page 1053. It's a long reading, and I think it speaks to itself. I'll just make two simple points at the end. So page 1053, Luke 15, verse 11. Again, Jesus telling this parable. There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into the far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his field to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now, his older son was in the field. As he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come and your father has killed a fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, look, these many years I have served you and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him. And he said to him, Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive, and he was lost and is found. So if you want a fuller treatment of that passage, then you want to go to the Grace Church Kingsway Facebook page, and no doubt Mike's sermon will be online there, so you can get a fuller explanation of that parable, which will be no doubt be very helpful. In that story, that parable that Jesus told, both sons swallowed essentially the same lie. The younger son, very openly and shockingly, asks for his inheritance whilst his father is still alive. Okay, so that's rather like saying, I wish you were dead, but I can't wait for you to die. Give me what's mine. It's like saying, I wish you were dead. I'm fed up with you. And then this younger son goes off and he wastes that money on wild living, as we read. So essentially what he does, he rejects the goodness of his father's household. He says, I wish you were dead. There's nothing here for me. Just give me what's mine. I'm off. And he looks for goodness elsewhere. He swallows the lie that you cannot be a Christian and also be truly happy, because God gets in the way. Ever heard that? That sentiment? You can't possibly be truly happy and a Christian because God's in the way. If God was out of church, it'd be great fun. The crazy equivalent is, I want to go to hell because of where the party is. People really are swallow the lie, don't they? That the really good fun time is where God isn't. That's what this younger son is. He's taken this hook, line, and sinker. Well, the older son is more subtle. He stays with his father, but he finds the whole experience of staying with his father rather a joyless duty. He doesn't really seem to be delighting in his father's house, does he? He's not enjoying the goodness of his father. And he's also swallowed the same lie. It's just that rather than rejecting his father, he kind of wishes he was somewhere else. But he carries on with doing what he's doing. It's not really a picture of great joy and happiness, is it? That's perhaps most commonly the experience of believers. That they come into the church having had this younger son experience where they've gone into the world, that they've kind of drained the world dry of all its so-called joy and discovered the cup. When it gets in the bottom of the cup, there's nothing left. It's dry. They come back to the Father, become a Christian, and then the devil sells them the same lie more subtly. You can't be really happy. It's nothing but rules here. That's the typical lie that takes you down to this road of not enjoying God. And we'll think about that tonight. Because that's what this older brother is. He's all bound up with duty, isn't he? I've done everything. But he hasn't got it. He hasn't understood his relationship with God. Everything that is his father's belongs to him. He's got the wrong attitude. So both miss the point that actually the Father, God, is goodness itself. That is the life we want. The best place to be is with him, enjoying all that he provides. Not, on the one hand, wishing we were somewhere else whilst going through the motions, or choosing to go somewhere else when we know we should be here. So on the spiritual battlefield of our daily life, when we're exposed and vulnerable, when something we perceive to be bad goes wrong in our life, the devil tells us that we're not truly happy in God, and we won't be happy in God. That we'd be happier doing something else, or being somewhere else, or being with someone else. That we're better off going back to our old ways. That God is not worth the trouble. That God secretly wants you to be unhappy. that God doesn't even know what is good for us. These are all the things that the devil will throw at you. It's all the same lie in different packaging. What must we remember at that point? Second rule, basic rule of survival. God is always good. Even when things go wrong. Especially when things go wrong. Forget that rule at that point, and your common fight's going to be a mess. God is always good, and He alone can truly satisfy. Life with God is the best life there is. That's what the Bible tells us. I read a book this week by a man called Tim Chester. He's a pastor in Sheffield, and the book's called You Can Change, and he writes this. God isn't just good. He's better than everything else and the true source of all joy. And that's the one thing the devil doesn't want you to know or believe. You can't be happy, truly, anywhere else. So now we come to an end, and I do want to say this quickly. We've got to work this from head knowledge into heart knowledge. That's the basic problem. We can all be nodding our heads here, but if it doesn't get into our hearts out there, we're going to forget these basic rules, and we're just going to panic when our days go pear-shaped and something wrong happens. So that's the issue. Getting these basic rules that we probably all have heard of before and would assent to become heart knowledge. So I think that the application is very straightforward. Each day of this week, and this is on your sheet, I think, I want you to start the day in a certain way. Let your first thought be a certain thought. And close the day in a certain way. Make it a discipline this week. So, I want to encourage you to begin your day by adopting this prayer. Father, this day belongs to you. You have planned it perfectly. Please help me to remember that and trust you when things don't go my way. Simple, isn't it? Will you do it? I think that's one way you can begin to get this basic rule into your heart so you can survive Monday through to Saturday safely. And then in the evening, let the last thing you think or say be another simple prayer. And do that as you're thinking about the moments in the day when you were in the heat of the battle, when those things did go wrong or something you perceived to be bad happened to you. Say something like this, Father, thank you. I could just stop there. We don't say thank you to our Father in heaven enough. If your last words before you go to sleep are thank you, Father, that's a good place to close the day out. But thank you for showing me your goodness this day. By teaching me to trust you and trust that you are always in control and leading me safely through another day. That would be good, wouldn't it? So, a morning and an evening prayer. Please put it into practice. Next week we're going to think a bit more about the role of prayer as we close our series called Our Common Fight Against Sin. Thank you.